Topic number 2. In the past, I have repeatedly given a warning about the deliberate, crushing shortages which are being arranged to strike America along with the collapse of the United States dollar and vanishing freedoms and property. And beginning in AUDIO LETTER No. 10 nearly 2 years ago, I have made public the Presidential Executive Orders which already exist, under which the declaration of a national emergency can be used to intensify shortages and suspend our Constitution. Today, the controlled Carter Administration is silently preparing for the intended declaration of a national emergency. Overseas, the Middle East is going faster and faster down the one-way corridor that is leading to war. And as I said last November, the attempted peace initiative to Israel by President Sadat of Egypt was an unnatural move for which he was programmed without his knowledge by certain elements within the CIA. Its purpose, unknown to Sadat himself, was to alter the situation in the Middle East in such a way that it would lead to war, not peace. And day by day now Sadat is becoming visibly more dejected and desperate. The controlled Carter Administration has discovered that it is not possible any longer to turn aside the Middle East war momentum. Thus the Carter Administration, flying the banner always of peace, peace, is now proposing a huge new sale of combat aircraft to Israel, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia. The real target in all of this is Saudi Arabia, which has made the fatal mistake of allowing itself to be dragged in now as a confrontation state against Israel. These maneuvers are continuing the public relations trickery of our secret rulers that began several months ago, giving the image to the public that we are becoming more aloof from Israel. At the same time, more and more excuses are being set up to make Israel appear to be threatened in a vital manner. Thus the cover story is being established for a preemptive limited nuclear strike against Arab OPEC oil wells. The war plan which I revealed in AUDIO LETTER No. 6 for November 1975 is being updated and set in motion now, and when it comes, the cutoff of Middle East oil will give our secret rulers the excuse to greatly intensify the regulation and limitation of our personal activities. As a prelude to this, America's longest coal strike is still underway. Last Friday evening, February 24, Jimmy Carter had announced that he would reveal drastic measures to end the strike in a speech scheduled for 9 p.m. Eastern Time. But instead, 2 hours before that, he announced a negotiated settlement reached at the last minute between the Miners' Union and the Rockefeller-controlled coal operators. He presented it to the nation as if there were nothing left to be concerned about, but the whole thing is nothing more than a ploy to waste time and finally provide an excuse for really harsh federal action. Every possible means is being used to ensure that the miners do not ratify the latest settlement, just as they turned down the earlier one several weeks ago. On one hand, the proposed contract is strewn with flaws designed to displease the rank-and-file miners. And on the other side of the coin, the miners are quietly being provided with many forms of support to deliberately minimize the pressure on them to settle. They are encouraged to pretend to outsiders that they have no money, and thereby qualify for food stamps, unemployment, and welfare assistance. In addition, credit unions are providing many miners with practically interest-free loans. Creditors are placing a moratorium on miners' accounts, and banks are not trying to collect miners' debts. Major creditors, controlled by our secret rulers, are setting the pace, and others are following their example. And so, if all goes according to plan, the early days of March will see the supposed new coal strike settlement break down. Jimmy Carter, as before, will delay and delay, but with utilities running out of coal, and the winter still not over, those drastic federal measures will be imposed at last. The emergency powers of the President will be invoked, seemingly for limited purposes, but at the same time the bureaucracy for the coming unlimited national emergency will have been set in motion. Topic number 3. In 1972, Colonel Raymond S. Sleeper, United States Air Force retired, wrote an article for the American Security Council entitled USSR, First in Space Power. It was published on March 6, 1972 in the Washington Report No. WR-72-4 of the American Security Council. In his article, Colonel Sleeper describes how Russia's space bomb satellite had already demonstrated its ability to blow up an enemy satellite in space, a concept that has now been superseded by the operational fleet of Cosmos particle beam interceptors. He also describes other facets of the widening lead in Soviet military use of space and says, quote, "They already have the capability to launch a major military space force to bludgeon the United States to accommodation on a particular request or demand," unquote. Illustrating how it could work, he begins with the words, quote, "Assume for the sake of an example that the impasse continues in the negotiations between the United States and the USSR for the limitation of strategic weapons, that is, SALT, and that the Soviet-sponsored European Security Conference is convened to reduce tensions," quote unquote, "on the continent," end of quote. Pointing out the vulnerable status of Europe relative to the Warsaw Pact forces, he continues, quote, "The USSR launches several orbital satellites. It tells the world they are orbital bombers. United States space detection systems verify the satellite's presence. The Soviets assert that the satellites are able to destroy any target in Europe or the United States, but that their real purpose is to ensure a peaceful Europe," unquote. With the West confronted with a dilemma over these satellites, Colonel Sleeper continues, quote, "Then to climax their ploy, the Soviets detonate a nuclear explosion over the eastern Atlantic Ocean, 50 or 100 miles out in space. All of Europe would be suitably impressed and would accept what, in view of this demonstration of Soviet military power, now seem very reasonable proposals for peaceful coexistence," quote unquote, "between the nations of Eastern and Western Europe. The United States, powerless, would be excluded," unquote. To obtain more details from Colonel Sleeper's account, I suggest you write to the American Security Council at Boston, Virginia, zip 22713. To bring Colonel Sleeper's scenario into virtual reality today, it is only necessary to add the elements of widespread sabotage, replace the hypothetical space bombers with Cosmos interceptor satellites and Cosmospheres, and realize that only government leaders are let in on these things today, not the public. Every time new snags develop in the SALT talks in Geneva, new explosions and other acts of Soviet intimidation increase in the United States. In recent weeks, the earlier predictions of an early SALT agreement have been replaced once again by stalling by our secret rulers, and once again disasters are striking seemingly at random around the United States. Last month, I told you that the Soviet Union is now ready, militarily, to destroy the United States in nuclear war and to survive our counterattack, if any. But I also informed you about a drastic new change within the Kremlin itself. With Leonid Brezhnev physically incapacitated, the hawks have taken over in the Kremlin since early December, and as a result, Soviet policies have become openly more aggressive lately. The situation as a result is highly volatile. Anything can happen. There's a major threat, as I warned you last month, that the military KGB secret police faction that now controls the Kremlin may step up the plans for war and strike without warning, which they are well able to do. Soviet nuclear mines now dot the United States. Soviet underwater nuclear missiles infest our territorial waters, including the Great Lakes. And as of my latest report, the Soviet submarine armadas I told you about last month are still there along our Pacific, Atlantic, and Gulf coasts. But in spite of this volatile situation and extreme danger, I should also give you the assessment of our secret rulers themselves so that you can understand their approach to the current situation. For more than 2 months following America's loss of the decisive Battle of the Harvest Moon in space last September, the controlled Carter administration was in complete disarray. In mid-October, with the American satellites evaporating in fireballs worldwide and the Soviet fleet in a pincers movement threatening imminent attack, the Carter administration sent its capitulation to Moscow. In other words, surrender by means of a lopsided SALT-II agreement would proceed. Both Soviet and American declarations indicated that SALT-II was moving fast. An agreement by the end of December was the deadline set by Brezhnev. But in November, violent cross-currents began surfacing over SALT. As I explained then, our rulers were stalling for time, using controversy in Congress as a shield. Immediately, Brezhnev tightened the screws with undersea detonation, the destruction of Toccoa Dam in Carter's home state of Georgia, a violent rail blast in Erie, South Korea, and other measures. Soon administration actions and statements appeared to be once again following the dictates of the Kremlin. In early December, with the original Brezhnev deadline on SALT-II drawing near, Soviet intimidation of America began mounting in rapid fashion. On December 2, 1977, the first of the mysterious airquakes along the East Coast began, courtesy of Soviet Cosmosphere No. 1 in the list of seven I made public that month. That same month, California experienced unprecedented sandstorms with 100-mile-per-hour winds as major Soviet weather modification measures began to take effect. And just 3 days before Christmas, Soviet nuclear mines began destroying grain elevators and other important targets in a continuing rash without precedent in our country. But by then, Leonid Brezhnev was a very sick man. He sickened rapidly, and I can now reveal that Leonid Brezhnev died in Moscow in early January. Beginning several weeks ago, a ceremonial double for Brezhnev has been making public appearances in order not to let the world know about the turbulence now going on within the Kremlin. But our unelected rulers know, and now they are using whatever time that is left to move desperately in a crash program to ally themselves with Red China and turn China into a credible threat against Russia. And wherever possible, military research and development is being cranked up secretly in a crash program to produce new weapons in time to effectively oppose the awesome military might of the Soviet Union. The United States' tilt toward China is reflected in the foreign policy statements of American officials. As recently as last November 16th, Defense Secretary Harold Brown told the Japanese that decreasing American commitments in the area would have to be expected. And yet early this month, he revealed in a foreign policy speech in California that the United States is giving renewed emphasis to our commitments in Asia. He's hurrying to reassure and bolster South Korea with new fighter aircraft, and privately there's some rethinking being done about the announced policy of withdrawing American troops there. He's also talking very differently than earlier about the necessity of retaining the major naval and Air Force facilities in the Philippines. My friends, our secret rulers and their advisors are telling themselves that they can hold off the Soviet Union for perhaps 2 to 3 years before the internal consolidation of the Kremlin bureaucracy takes hold. By then, our secret rulers hope to have Red China firmly in hand, ready to throw into the fray with Russia. And in all of this, the tremendous financial grip of Japan by our secret rulers, the four Rockefeller brothers, is being used as a major tool. Japan has just signed an historic 8-year, $20 billion trade agreement with China, which already is thawing the diplomatic ice between these two Asian giants. Meanwhile, Rockefeller doors are being flung wide open for Red China here and abroad, and Red Chinese trade delegations are hustling around the United States, Europe, Asia, and Japan in a rush of activity. All of this may sound as if the mighty Rockefellers are going to pull a rabbit out of that hat once again, as they have done in the past and still end up on top. But what they are actually doing, my friends, is digging an ever deeper, wider grave for themselves and for America. The Soviet Union saw long ago what is now happening and has already prepared Japan to join in agreements to offset those with China. Japan will in due course sign in principle a draft of a treaty of friendship and cooperation in spite of Japan's demands for the return of four Japanese islands seized by Russia at the end of World War II. The Rockefeller economic power in Japan is formidable, but the Japanese want out from under the Rockefeller yoke. Quoting now from my book, page 76, "This situation could continue for a reasonable length of time, culminating in Japan's causing China and the Soviet Union to join with her in agreements opening huge economic markets stretching from East Germany to the far reaches of East Asia. These agreements would constitute, in effect, a military alliance between the three Asian powers, and thus would be born in this century another Axis, a Moscow-Tokyo-Peking Axis, a new gigantic Asian power bloc, cemented on Moscow-Tokyo-Peking relations, three Asian giants." End of quotation from my book. The Rockefellers helped Soviet Russia to grow into the world's number one military power, only to lose control over their Frankenstein monster, but it seems they never learn. Now the process of building up Red China as fast as possible has begun, and that will end in utter catastrophe. Ultimately, the forces tending to join Russia, China, and Japan in a giant new Asian axis far outweigh the minor influences the Rockefellers can bring to bear. The Rockefellers are right in believing that a process of settling in and consolidation lies ahead for the Kremlin, but they are wrong, dead wrong, in believing this will weaken the Kremlin to such a point that the present overwhelming Soviet military advantage will be allowed to slip away. The Soviet Union, increasingly under the influence of Defense Minister Marshal Dmitry Ustinov, is keeping a close eye on the military situation. The Rockefeller dream of overturning the Soviet advances in military technology in the space of 2 to 3 years is unrealistic to the point of arrogance, but just to make sure, Soviet sabotage of key plants and installations nationwide has already been carried out. For example, consider a small sampling in my own hometown of Huntington, West Virginia. The International Nickel plant now contains 3 Soviet nuclear weapons, the Owens, Illinois plant, 2, and the Hudao plant, where secret work is underway, 2. In addition to sabotage, my friends, there's a campaign of espionage by the Soviet KGB against America. On February 9, earlier this month, a sensational Soviet spy case broke in Canada. Last April in AUDIO LETTER 23, I revealed that Soviet agents were planting nuclear weapons in dams and reservoirs in the United States, and the following month I detailed the role of Canada being used as a staging area into the United States by the KGB. In AUDIO LETTER 24, I revealed the crucial role played by the RCMP, the Mounties, in attempting to stop the growing sabotage of the United States while American authorities were doing nothing whatever about it. Now we've been told publicly that the Mounties have been involved since at least last April in a counterintelligence operation against KGB operations in Canada, and the RCMP has received a lot of praise in place of the usual abuse for their breakup of the celebrated KGB spy ring. 13 spies, diplomatic personnel at the Soviet Embassy in Ottawa, have been expelled. In recent years, Soviet espionage cases have been boiling over repeatedly in the West, major cases involving top military and governmental officials and the compromise of massive amounts of sensational and sensitive material. It has happened in Canada, in Britain, which recently expelled over 100 Soviet spies, in Sweden, in Denmark, in West Germany, and even in Switzerland. But here in the United States, the biggest of all Soviet espionage targets, the KGB has become so powerful that no such exposures happen. A big deal was made recently of spying activities by a single diplomat from a superpower known as Vietnam, but not a word about the thousands of KGB agents which have been crisscrossing our land planting nuclear mines for the coming war. The situation would be different had J. Edgar Hoover not been murdered, but then Nelson Rockefeller always said the FBI was a fascist organization. Can you imagine? But in spite of the good publicity the Mounties received from the big spy case in Canada, the RCMP is not happy because the KGB won rather than losing in that case. The Ottawa spy ring case was deliberately exposed prematurely by a Soviet agent who fed the story to a Canadian reporter. The story was printed, the RCMP's cover was blown, and the massive KGB operations now underway in Canada were rendered safer than ever, because in Canada as here, the KGB has friends in very high places. At the present time, big Aleutian airliners of the Soviet airline Aeroflot, together with Cuban, Polish, and Czechoslovakian airliners, can be seen frequently at the Mirabel and Dorval airports in Montreal. This despite the fact that very few commercial air travelers fly between Canada and Eastern Europe. In addition, camouflaged Soviet troop transports, each able to carry 50 fully armed troops with supplies and bearing no identification marks, have also been passing through the Montreal airports in large groups. Operating under the protection of certain very highly placed agents in the Canadian government, the KGB has established no fewer than 12 guerrilla camps in remote areas of Quebec province. At the present time, over 3,000 KGB-trained personnel are in Canada, able to speak fluent English and prepared to infiltrate into the United States at will. Unlike the Canadian and American citizens who have acted as Soviet agents in planting nuclear mines nationwide, these are trained guerrillas, prepared to undertake important insurgency operations against targets either in Canada or in the United States. By weather modification, by sabotage, by espionage, and by other means, a secret war is now underway between the Kremlin and the United States over SALT II, which is to be America's surrender treaty. The casualties in this secret war are civilians, and the toll is rising. The men, women, and children killed in the Toccoa Falls Dam collapse are casualties in this secret war. The workers and inspectors killed and injured in the explosion of sabotaged grain elevators are casualties in this secret war. Those who have died in artificial killer storms are casualties in this secret war. And those who were killed and injured recently in the propane explosion at Waverly, Tennessee are casualties in this secret war. Last time it was Erie, South Korea, back in November. A railroad car full of dynamite was used as the perfect cover for the detonation of two fairly large buried nuclear mines. This time it was brought closer to home. In Waverly, two tank cars full of propane were derailed on Wednesday, February the 22nd, but they lay there safely till Friday, until just before workmen were about to start emptying them. Then, without warning and with no apparent cause, one tank exploded, as some witnesses said, quote, like an atomic bomb, unquote. A huge black mushroom cloud billowed into the sky, leaving over 9 dead, scores injured, and the downtown area flattened and burning. Philip Hooper, vice president of the L&N Railroad, said, quote, it was unusual. These derailed cars were there for 24 hours and did not leak. We had a call from our expert at the car that they were going to begin the transfer in 8 minutes. Then it blew. It did not follow a normal explosion. It ruptured, then it exploded, unquote. Thus, another KGB sabotage operation within our own country drew to a close. Sabotage brought about the derailment and the explosion. Sabotage targets also include oil tank farms, oil pipelines, and other like installations. In the closing words of my book, I warned 5 years ago that, quote, if the new Asian forces are not understood but are met with ignorance and arrogance, then the world will indeed be headed not for a generation of peace, of which President Nixon has so proudly boasted, but for World War III." Unquote. Today, our secret rulers are meeting the new Asian forces with the ignorance and arrogance of those who do not recognize any power higher than themselves. By so doing, they are bringing the wrath of God upon themselves and upon all the rest of us. We will be chastised as well as cleansed in the process. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless and protect each and every one of you.